Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Rob Nixon. We're talking about Rachel Carson, one of the most lyrical, most poetically gifted of scientists when it came to observing the sea around us, as she called it in a landmark book. Where does the poet, Rachel Carson, start to see things going wrong with the connection between man and nature?
Well, very close to her Maryland home, there was a wildlife refuge where some researchers had started doing experiments on the impact of DDT on the wildlife. And as early as 1945, she wrote to the Reader's Digest suggesting that she write an article on this research, and they turned her down. Presumably it was too depressing and
not quite glossy enough. I
they thought laughter was the best medicine.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Laughter was the best medicine. And so she didn't write much on that topic. She stayed pretty much with the ocean until the late 50s, when this idea of the Silent Spring took off. And there were two catalysts for that. One was a letter from a woman called Olga Huckins describing the devastation of the wildlife and birds in her backyard and communicating her feeling of impotence and absolute frustration. How was she to stop these spraying runs of DDT at the time? And that letter quickened something in Rachel Carson herself. Clearly this had been a concern of her through the years. At the same time, there was a case in Long Island that was brought against the federal government for DDT spraying against gypsy moths in Long Island by a group that called itself the Committee Against Mass Poisoning. And during that case, which they lost, there was enormous amount of testimony from scientists, from medical people, on the impact on toxins. And Rachel Carson ended up drawing on a lot of the details and of that testimony in Silent Spring. But when she heard about that case, this would have been, I think, 1958, she wrote to Wallace Shawn at the New Yorker, who had published, serialized some of the sea around us, and said, this is a really urgent issue. This case should be covered. And initially she had suggested E.B. White as a writer to do it, and they decided that she would be the more appropriate person. So I think those were two events, the personal letter and this landmark case, that came together and really gave her the initial impetus.
Where did the title come from?
She didn't have a title initially, or she thought about something to do with man's war on nature. The title, The Silent Spring, I think was connected to this letter from Olga Huckins and from others who described the death of birds in their backyards and their horror of the Silent Spring. People would write in and say, we've been having migrating birds coming through here year after year, and my garden is eerily silent. What's going on? And it seemed to only start with these spraying runs. The epigraph to Silent Spring is from the Keats poem, La Belle Dame sans Merci, and the two lines that she quotes are, the sedge is withered from the lake and no birds sing. Such a simple pair of lines, mm-hmm. and yet says so much. And I think for somebody like Carson, who was particularly attracted to these liminal zones, you know, the sedge at the edge of the lake, the tidal pools and the edge of the ocean, where you get such ecological richness, where different ecosystems come into contact, those lines must really have resonated for her.
How does she go about then researching these claims? It's one thing to see, you know, the symptoms, but it's another to actually verify what the underlying cause is.
Yeah, there was an enormous amount of research labor involved, endless writing of letters. Fortunately, she did tap into a informal community of scientists across the country, indeed across the world. There were people writing to her from England and Europe who made common cause with her and helped her amass information. She also wrote to various government agencies, Department of Agriculture and so forth, and on the whole found them secretive, foot-dragging, disobliging for all the predictable reasons. She wrote to pesticide corporations and so forth. Eventually, when her health was ailing and she needed assistance, and she hired a young secretary who had a training in the sciences and was an enormous resource. But it was just a fantastic amount of letter writing and research that she had to do in an age without the internet.
And what sort of strategy does she use then if she's going to put together this book, Silent Spring, with the goal of bringing about change? What sort of rhetorical strategy does she use to get people to come to her way of thinking?
I think there's a very interesting mix of strategies, and it's one of the reasons why this makes Silent Spring such an exciting book to teach, is that Rachel Carson is one of the great persuaders. I mean, she tried to persuade people of something, and it actually worked, at least changed public awareness, changed laws. So it's a fascinating book to look at rhetorically. And she moves in it between a number of different voices. Sometimes she's quite metaphorical, poetic, sometimes she's wry, sometimes she is clearly outraged and very angry. Very often she ends the chapters with a series of questions, almost apocalyptic questions. You know, there's a sense of her giving these scientific case studies, summarizing these scientific case studies, and then moving all of that towards some final appeal that has more of a philosophical character, has more of an ethical character, broadening it out. Look at the way she ends the book, which gives a sense of the more polemical side to her voice. As crude a weapon as the caveman's club, the chemical barrage has been hurled against the fabric of life, a fabric on the one hand delicate and destructible, on the other miraculously tough and resilient, and capable of striking back in unexpected ways. These extraordinary capacities of life have been ignored by the practitioners of chemical control, who have brought to their task no high-minded orientation, no humility before the vast forces with which they tamper. The control of nature is a phrase conceived in arrogance, born of the Neanderthal age of biology and philosophy, when it was supposed that nature exists for the convenience of man. The concepts and practices of applied entomology, for the most part, date from that stone age of science. It is our alarming misfortune that so primitive a science has armed itself with the most modern and terrible weapons, and that in turning them against the insects, it has also turned them against the earth. So very often, towards the end of the chapters particularly, she moves into this apocalyptic voice.
Now, she has, at this point, clearly given up on any kind of dialogue with the pesticide manufacturers, and she is just really taking them to task.
Absolutely. And I think when the book came out, that's when the dialogue began. It was quite vociferous.
Imagine that.
For dialogue, and the response was very divided. I mean, the book met with an enormous amount of acclaim and enormous amount of hostility. One of the characteristic tracks of her disparages was to say that the book was emotional and often hysterical, or somebody called her a priestess of nature, you know. And I think one of the finest features of the book is the fact that she can be transcendental but also a scientifically substantial note that is maintained pretty much throughout. A lot of the controversy centered on the opening of the book, the fable, which I'll read from, which is very, I mean, it's like something out of Grimm Brothers or Hans Christian Andersen. It's a story for adult children, really. And it's a very good ploy for opening up the book to a general audience. By the time you're several chapters in, particularly the chapter called The Elixirs of Death, that chapter, she gets into some pretty hardcore science and chemistry, and I'm sure many, many readers, myself included, have skipped over sections of that chapter.
The proofs.
The proofs,
kind of like the blubber chapters in Moby Dick,
yes,
the blubber of the whale.
Exactly. Yes. But I'll read from the opening because I think it's very, very well crafted. This is called A Fable for Tomorrow. There was once a town in the heart of America where all life seemed to live in harmony with its surroundings. The town lay in the midst of a checkerboard of prosperous farms, with fields of grain and hillsides of orchards, where, in spring, white clouds of bloom drifted above the green fields. In autumn, oak and maple and birch set up a blaze of color that flamed and flickered across a backdrop of pines. Then foxes barked in the hills and deer silently crossed the fields, half hidden in the mists of the fall mornings. And she goes on to flesh out this wonderful town and then describes the sickness that descends on it. A strange blight crept over the area and everything began to change. Some evil spell had settled on the community. Mysterious maladies swept the flocks of chickens, the cattle and sheep sickened and died. Everywhere was a shadow of death. The farmers spoke of much illness among their families. In the towns, the doctors had become more and more puzzled by new kinds of sickness appearing among their patients. Then she goes on to describe the strange stillness, the disappearance and silencing of the birds. She concludes, "On the farms, the hens brooded, but no chicks hatched. The farmers complained that they were unable to raise any pigs. The litters were small, and the young survived only a few days. The apple trees were coming into bloom, but no bees droned among the blossoms, so there was no pollination, and there would be no fruit. The roadsides, once so attractive, were now lined with browned and withered vegetation as though swept by fire. These too were silent, deserted by all living things. Even the streams were now lifeless. Anglers no longer visited them, for all the fish had died. In the gutters, under the eaves, and between the shingles of the roofs, a white granular powder still showed a few patches. Some weeks before it had fallen like snow upon the roofs and the lawns, the fields and streams. No witchcraft, no enemy action had silenced the rebirth of new life in the stricken world. The people had done it to themselves." Then she goes on to say how no such town actually exists, but that it has 1,000 counterparts across America, and this is a composite portrait of things that genuinely happened. So the town is at once mythic and constructed out of elements of towns right across America.
But as in any fairy tale, you've got a sort of all or nothing approach. And one thing I'm wondering about, I mean, because anyone who's gardened or tried to farm knows that pests can be a plague and you can lose entire crops if you don't have access to something to help with it. In Silent Spring, does she, despite the opposition from the pesticide companies, does she acknowledge the rationale behind the use of such things, and does she hit in any way sort of a middle ground or a compromise?
Yes, I think this is clear in the book, and it was clear in the exchanges between her and Robert White Stevens in the 1963 film, that she says very emphatically that she's not opposed to pesticides per se. What she advocates, among other things, is greater research into the effects, particularly of these broad-spectrum pesticides like dieldrin and DDT that were being used, lavished on the landscape at that time. And she also recommended greater research into biological controls. Now, one of the issues clearly with something like DDT is that there was a tendency at that time to see insects as the enemy, you know, as enemy insurgents in a kind of blanket way. And clearly the primary controls on insects are other insects and birds. And so that if you can get the semblance of eradication was a big 50s word, you can get a semblance of successful eradication in which you're actually eradicating part of your controls. And she was arguing that there were many ways that were underfunded and under-researched and under-applied for using biological controls to supplement well-researched use of pesticides. Things like sterilizing males and releasing them into community and getting secretion of insects to attract them into traps, and many other examples that she gave. So she felt that this focus on eradication was part of the general climate of unthinking technological hubris, rather than being a purist. She wasn't opposed to pesticides completely. But one of the things to remember is that this was a period of astronomical suburban growth. And we even get a feeling for that in that fable at the beginning of Silent Spring, this town emerging in the countryside. And much of the growth in the pesticide industry came from people realizing that there was a new kind of rural space, the suburban garden, and there was a new market for pesticides in the suburban home, the kitchen and so forth.
Well, and in the outdoors, too. I mean, in the 50s and into the 60s, it was very common for, at dusk usually, early evening, for this small truck to come through suburban streets spraying literally clouds of pesticides, I mean, that would rise up 30, 40, 50 feet into a second-story window, and this would be a routine practice.
Absolutely.
And little kids like me would play in that stuff because it was fun to run through the cloud behind the truck.
Yeah, there was a, I think, 1985 film on PBS did on Rachel Carson, and they have some of that footage of exactly what you're saying, you know, kids running behind the truck as if it's an ice cream van. They have some footage of people coming through a school luncheon cafeteria spraying DDT over the kids as they're eating their sandwiches to get rid of the lice or something.
Sure, yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a great way to de-louse people.
So it was pretty indiscriminate, and the clouds were a plaything for a lot of kids, and it was a sense that you were wiping out the mosquitoes and making the suburbs even more desirable. But the growth in the suburbs was so sudden and so sizable that what you found was that pesticides that had an agricultural application were just being shifted into the home. And there was not a lot of time, even far less research or thought going into the fact that something might be suitable on a farm and not suitable in the kitchen. It was a sense of taking the war against nature into the domestic realm. And so clearly that was a problem. And though some critics saw Rachel Carson as overly emotional and saddled her with being a woman, and so she was inadequately scientific, there was also a way in which she could turn some of that to her advantage, of the cultural idea of women as more caring. And in a number of places in the book, she shifts from this apocalyptic tone and from the scientific tone into domestic scenes, into a scene at the backyard bird feeder or a cleaning scene in the kitchen, and uses her woman's voice, in a sense, I think, to spread concern to women in particular who are living the suburban life. I mean, the first generation very often of women entering the suburbs. I thought I'd read a couple of passages that have to do with that. This is a passage where she's talking about the penetration of pesticide into the home. If a huge skull and crossbones were suspended above the insecticide department, the customer might at least enter it with the respect normally accorded death-dealing materials. But instead the display is homey and cheerful, and with the pickles and olives across the aisle and the bath and laundry soaps adjoining, the rows upon rows of insecticides are displayed. Within easy reach of a child's exploring hand are chemicals in glass containers. If dropped to the floor by a child or careless adult, everyone nearby could be splashed with the same chemical that has sent spraymen using it into convulsions. These hazards, of course, follow the purchaser right into his home. Use of poisons in the kitchen is made both attractive and easy. Kitchen shelf paper, white or tinted to match one's color scheme, may be impregnated with insecticide, not merely on one, but on both sides. Manufacturers offer us do-it-yourself booklets on how to kill bugs. With push-button ease, one may send a fog of dieldrin into the most inaccessible nooks and crannies off cabinets, corners, and baseboards. We can polish our floors with a wax guaranteed to kill any insect that walks over it. We can hang strips impregnated with the chemical lindane in our closets and garment bags, or place them in our bureau drawers for half year's freedom from worry over moth damage. The advertisements contain no suggestion that lindane is dangerous, and so forth. So she periodically ventures into the home. She will cite an entire letter from a woman, I think, in suburban Illinois, talking about the course of events at her backyard bird feeder, after a series of spraying runs and so forth. So there's an ordinariness to the appeal of the book as well, I think.
We'll find out how Silent Spring's message prevailed in just a moment. This is University of the Year.
To get started, visit our website, wpr.org.